Chapter 12. Growing Things. The Martians came up a week after we did. We helped them unload their few packages. Earth normal weight was oppressive to them, and they clumped around with exaggerated care. Well, it wasn't exaggeration. Like having to carry around a weight 1.5 times as heavy as you are. Carry it for 13 years with no relief. Snowbird didn't complain, but her voice was unnaturally high and reedy. I doubt that they spoke much English on the way up. I put my arm gently around her shoulders. It's very hard, isn't it? Hard for you too, Carmen. You haven't been to Earth in a long time. I exercise in Earth gravity every day. I should do that, she said. Become Earth strong. By the time we return, the quarantine may be lifted. Fly and Amber, behind us, made a dismal noise. I have a better idea. Let's just go home. We can't live this way. She gave him a long blast and high-pitched growl in consensus Martian, and he squawked and clattered back. She turned back to me. Perhaps we should rest in Mars territory for a while. They plodded off, muttering. Before long, they'll be in zero gravity, Paul said. He'll complain about that, too. The last thing we would have to do before Paul cut us loose was to tape things down, mostly chairs. When we were flung away from the space elevator, we'd be in free fall, like someone jumping out of an airplane. But we would plummet for 11 days, jostled every now and then by steering jets. That would be tomorrow. The habitat didn't have any independent propulsion, of course, but it was firmly attached to the ship that would eventually be our landing vessel, much smaller. It would fly away like an eagle clutching an elephant. Before that, we had to water the plants. We'd spent 6 days following the directions the hydroponic engineers had left behind, making sure all the root structures could be kept moist without water surrounding them. There was a water-absorbent granular medium held inside a fine mesh net for each plant or group of plants. There was no automation in this temporary arrangement, of course. Every morning we'd spend an hour giving each plant a measured shot of water from a portable hydrator, a water pump with a hose and syringe. The first morning, still in gravity, I split the chore with Dustin. It was interesting to get him alone. He usually deferred to Namir or Elsa. I had to ask him about his weird family growing up. I never gave it much thought, I said. But isn't it strange that a person who winds up in espionage should have grown up in a commune with anarchist parents? He laughed. Not so odd. Like a kid whose parents are lawyers or cops might want to escape and become a bohemian artist. I didn't want to be a spy anyhow. A philosophy degree doesn't open many doors, though. The Space Force paid through my doctorate in exchange for 4 years' service, which I thought was going to be in communications. You go where they send you, though. They needed engineers for communication. And philosophers for spookery? It's a grab bag, intelligence. Not that they'd ever admit it, but it's where you go if you have education but no useful skills. The personnel database says there are 3 other philosophy PhDs in intelligence. We ought to get together, form a cabal. Namir says there are more officers in intelligence than any other part of the military. He nodded amiably, as if that were a good thing. It's been that way for a long time. I've never known a philosopher before. If it wasn't for the Space Force, what would you be doing? Staying out of harm's way. You know, sit around, think deep thoughts, beg for scraps. And teach, I suppose? And write papers that 2 or 3 people will read. The bush he was watering had tiny white flowers with a penetrating sweet smell. He bent down and breathed deeply and read the label. Martian? Martian miniature limes. They tweaked the genes so it wouldn't be all branch, growing tall in Martian gravity. We'll see what it does in 1G. The past year and a half, I've been assigned to a think tank in Washington. All the services, multidisciplinary. The ethics of military intervention. Any conclusions? He made a sound I'd come to recognize, A puff of air through his nose. Amusement, contempt, maybe patience. Under the present conditions, it's hard to justify most wars, anyhow, that aren't a purely defensive reaction to invasion. But now, with the others threatening the whole human race with casual destruction, how does anyone justify a war against any human enemy? Is that a question I'm supposed to answer? No. He growled a string of foreign syllables. That's Farsi. There is some shit a man does not have to eat. Adapted from American English, I think, though the principle is widely spread. But it implies there's another kind of shit that a man does have to eat. Glad I'm a woman. He smiled at me. See? You're a philosopher already. He sniffed the lime flowers again. Though living on recycled shit is something I tried to become philosophical about before we came up. Hunger helps. It dominated the menu in Little Mars. The pantry machine broke up all organic waste, and some inorganic, and put it back together to make amino acids, then protein. Mixed in with measured amounts of carbohydrates and fiber and fat, some trace elements, it could produce blocks of edible stuff in programmed colors, textures, and flavors. Elsa said that Namir is a good cook. I wonder what he can do with pseudo-beef and pseudo-chicken.
Make pseudo-beef stroganoff and pseudo-chicken Florentine, I guess.
He sighed and leaned back against the lattice that would be supporting bean vines. Carmen, what do you think our chances really are? Are we just wasting our time? Intuition, I mean, not science. I don't think you can do science without data. I do have an intuition, though. Or an optimistic delusion. I sat down on the edge of the tank. Do you know the story of the lucky chicken?
Tell me.
Well, suppose you had a flat of fertilized chicken eggs. That's 144. And you drop the flat from waist height or shoulder height. Some eggs would break. Discard them and do it again and again until finally you have just one egg.
The lucky egg.
You're getting it. You hatch it and collect its fertilized eggs. Unless it's a rooster. Then you have to start over, I guess. But you do the same thing, dropping them over and over until one survives. Then you wait for it to mature and collect its eggs. And again and again.
I see, he said.
Eventually, you will produce the luckiest chicken in the world. The version I heard, the benefactor was the Pope. He put the chicken in a fancy papal chicken basket, and it never left his side. So nothing bad ever happened to him.
This is not the last Pope we're talking about, then.
Not a real Pope. Me, actually. I'm the lucky chicken.
They dropped your mother from a great height?
He was so much like Paul, I could smack him.
Not that I know of.
But ever since I got to Mars, I've had the most incredible luck. All the Mars girl crap. All kinds of trouble, and I always seem to come out on top. So maybe my main qualification for this job is as a talisman. Stay close to me, the way the Pope stayed close to his lucky chicken.
He was nodding, looking serious. You do believe in luck?
Well, at some level, I suppose I do. Not in lucky charms, talismans, but just as an observation, sure. Some people seem to be lucky all the time, while others seem to be born losers.
That's true enough. Something that statistics would predict.
I suppose you could pretend to be scientific and put the whole population on a bell curve, just like you would for height or weight. Normal people bulking up in the middle, the unlucky ones off to the left, the luckiest trailing off on the right.
Aha! He grinned and rubbed his beard. There's your fallacy. You can only do it with dead people.
What?
Dead people have all run out of luck.
No,
I mean, all you can say of someone is after the fact.
He was lucky all his life, or she was unlucky.
But a living, breathing person always has tomorrow to worry about.
You could be the luckiest person in the world, in two worlds, in the whole universe.
But some tomorrow, like the day you meet the others, boom, your luck runs out, like a gambler's winning streak. And in that particular case, so does everybody else's.
Are you always such an optimist?
He picked up his hydrator, and we moved on to the next patch.
By Earth standards, America anyhow, I really am an optimist.
You can define that as anyone who isn't suicidally depressed.
There may be free energy, but that doesn't translate into universal prosperity. Most people work at unsatisfying jobs with ambiguous or worthless goals and low pay, and anyhow, they're just marking time until the end of the world. Namir and Elsa and I, like you guys, are in the unique position of being able to do something about it.
I was still living in a kind of double vision world, the sanitized version that was broadcast, and which I sort of believed for years, versus the grim reality that was in Namir's newspaper. And America was far from being the worst off. The front page picture in the last paper showed the Ganges, a clot of corpses from shore to shore, a block-wide funeral pyre in Kuala Lumpur, within sight of the proud old Twin Towers. These were beets. 4 small plants per net bag. 50 cc's water each. I wouldn't touch beets as a girl. But in Mars I came to love them.
Red planet and all.
I mentioned that to Dustin. He laughed.
I grew up in a vegetarian family. Beets were the closest thing I had to meat until I got off the commune.
Bothers you to go back to veggies?
No. I just eat to fuel up. Pseudo-hot dogs with fake mustard, yum. Elsa's about the same. Namir might go crazy, though.
He likes his meat?
Fish, actually. He doesn't like to be far from the sea. You better take a good last look. On Mars, you had actual fish.
We said in Mars, usually. A pool of tilapia. They lived on plant waste.
He was hoping.
Guess we're not a big enough biome. It was marginal on Mars, a luxury, and we didn't have to deal with water at 0G. I clicked on the notebook. 20 kilos of dried fish in the storeroom. The storeroom was already in place on the iceberg. It had 500 kilos of luxury food, including 50 liters of 200-proof alcohol, more than enough for each of us to have 2 drinks a day.
He can do something with dried fish. Spanish. Some kind of fritters.
His smile was interesting.
You really like him. I mean, apart from... There's no apart from, but yes, we're closer than I ever was with any of my natural family.
I wasn't sure how to interpret that. I wanted prurient details.
You knew Elsa first, though.
By a few weeks, maybe a month. By then, it was obviously a package deal or no deal.
I'd heard of Namir professionally and was curious anyhow. We first met without her. Very American. Shooting pool.
You beat the pants off him?
Not a chance. He's a shark. Shows no mercy.
You knew about him and Gehenna?
In what way?
He said without inflection.
That he missed the first part and... so survived the second.
Oh, sure.
He was about the highest-ranking officer of the Mossad in Israel, certainly in Tel Aviv, who survived.
That was interesting. I wonder why he didn't press his advantage with that.
How so?
He's still with the UN, isn't he? If he'd stayed in Israel...
He laughed. Smartest thing he ever did was go back to New York. Lots of ruthless people jockeying for position in the Mossad, with 3/4 of them suddenly gone. His turf in New York was safe. Besides, it's the place he loves best.
We moved on to the delicate celery plants. There's an odd train of circumstance that winds up putting the three of us here, as if we're collectively a lucky chicken, or an unlucky one.
What makes you say that?
Like this. The corporation wound up agreeing that they needed no more or less than 3 military people on the mission. So they sent the computers out sniffing for the 3 military people who could live together in close quarters for 13 years, getting along with 4 civilians at the same time, people who had a certain amount of academic training and professional accomplishment. They didn't want 3 men or 3 women, so as not to have one gender dominate on Ad Astra. And they had to be spies, of course. Don't forget that. In fact, the probability that they'd come from intelligence was high. A person who'd spent his professional life shooting down planes or disarming bombs wouldn't be too useful. They wanted one of the three to be a medical doctor, too, who'd done general practice. We all agreed on that. Someone who could work without consultation. That may be what happened. The computer pulled out Elsa, and she dragged me and Namir along.
That could be it, I said. But computers have to be programmed, and it would be easy to start out with Namir and his mates and make sure they would be the ones the program selected.
I'd hold him like this. He was picking up the plant by its stalk. I slid my hand under the ball of medium and lifted it out.
Right, he said.
Have to be careful with the babies.
Were you going to have any?
I asked.
Before you got orders to waltz off into outer space and tilt with monsters?
Well, neither Elsa nor Namir wanted any children. They're not that optimistic about the future, immediate or distant. If it were up to me, yes, I'd like to watch one grow up, help it grow up.
Sort of a social experiment?
A philosophical one? Cold-blooded, I know. You have two?
Technically.
They were born ex utero, though, for which my utero is grateful. And they're being raised by the community in Mars, which I don't like much.
You're so right. Speaking as someone who was raised by a commune, with my mother and father warned not to bond too closely.
You didn't have a mother figure or father figure at all?
No.
There was a couple in charge of children, but it was obvious we were just a chore. They were pretty harsh.
That must have been rough. The two in charge of our kids are nice people. I've known them for years.
Good luck. Ours were nice to adults.
We moved on to the carrots, frilly and delicate.
Working in Washington, did you commute every day?
No. I had a little flat in Georgetown. Go back to New York on Thursday night or Friday. Sometimes bring Elsa back to D.C. if our schedules allowed. Sometimes I'd just go up overnight. It's only an hour and a half on the metro.
Best of both worlds.
Started out that way.
Washington's falling apart.
Both the cities, actually. Less comfortable, more dangerous.
Did you go armed?
No. I'm fatalistic about that. Elsa had a gun, but I don't think she carried it normally. Namir usually did, and he had a bodyguard as well. But he was threatened all the time, and attacked once.
In the city?
Oh, yeah. Right downtown. Stepped off the Broadway slidewalk, and a woman shot him point-blank in the chest. Somehow she missed his heart. She turned to run away, and the bodyguard killed her.
He shook his head.
He got hell for that, the bodyguard. No idea who she might have been working for. No fingerprints or eye prints. DNA finally tracked her down to Amsterdam. She'd been a sex worker there 20 years before.
No connection with Gehenna?
He shook his head.
And Namir says he's never used the services of a sex worker, not even in Amsterdam.
Men lie about that, but I'm inclined to believe him.
Point blank in the chest. That must have laid him low for a long time.
Had to grow a new lung. Takes weeks, and it's no fun.
Another bit of mystery for the mystery man. He's made other enemies, obviously, since Gehenna, being a peacekeeper. Mostly in Africa. Very few pale, beautiful blondes. It's not my field, but I assume you could hire one. Yes and no. In New York, you could rent a beautiful blonde hit woman and probably specify right or left-handed. But you can't hire someone so totally off the grid. Not in America. If she ordered a meal in a restaurant, she'd get a cop along with the check, asking what planet she'd just dropped in from. It's gotten that bad? Since Triton, yeah. But even then, a couple of years before that, America was more cautious than most places. A police state, my mother said. She calls herself a radical, though. He laughed. She's no more radical than I am, from her dossier.
You've read my mother's dossier?
Oh, sorry. You thought I was a lepidopterist. No, but I assumed you'd read mine and everybody's... I'm just nosy. And 7 days is a long time to kill on the space elevator.
So, what about my father? Was he banging his secretary?
Nothing personal. Just blowjobs. He smiled at my reaction. Bad joke, Carmen. Sorry. Sometimes my mouth gets into gear a little ahead of my brain. I like that in a spy, I said. Not sure whether I did. Not so Earl Carradine. You see the last one, he said, where he solves your little problem with the others? Haven't had the pleasure. What, he takes his Swiss Army knife and turns a bicycle into a starship? No. He discovers the whole thing is a hoax from a corrupt cabal of capitalists. Oh, good. We can go home now. It actually was a little clever this time. Not so much gadgets and gunplay. I had to laugh. Unlike real life, where a beautiful blonde mystery woman nails the spy as he steps off the Broadway slidewalk. For God's sake! What can I say? He injected the last carrot punch. Life does imitate art sometimes. We could have just stayed in the habitat for launch, which might have been fun. Suddenly detached from the space elevator, we'd be flung toward the iceberg at a great rate of speed. But the sensation to us would be, oops, someone turned off the gravity. For safety's sake, though, all of us climbed through the connecting tube into the spaceship Ad Astra. We should come up with a separate name for the habitat. San Quentin, maybe? Or Alcatraz? We helped the Martians get strapped into their hobby horse restraints. With all those arms, they still can't reach their backs. And then got into our own couches, over-engineered with lots of padding and buckles. But that was for the landing, 6.4 years from now, at least. Paul didn't expect any violent maneuvers on the way to the iceberg. There were two course corrections planned right after launch, and unpredictable refinements as we approached the iceberg. Paul had said to expect a loud bang, and indeed it was about the loudest thing I'd ever heard. No noise in space, of course, but the 8 explosive bolts that separated the habitat from the elevator made the whole structure reverberate. "Stay strapped in for a few minutes," he said, and counted down from 5 seconds. The attitude jets hissed faintly for a minute and stuttered. Then the main drive blasted for a few minutes, loud, but not as deafening as the bolt had been. I suppose it was a quarter of a G or so, not quite Martian gravity. "That should do it. Put on your slippers and let's go check for damage." Our gecko slippers would allow us to walk, as if there were weak glue on our soles, down the ship's corridor and through most of the habitat. The sticky patches on the walls and floor and ceiling were beige circles big enough for 1 foot. You could squeeze both feet into one if you liked the sensation of being a bug stuck in a spider web. Those of us used to zero G just sailed through the tube into the habitat, the others picking their way along behind us. Namir was game for floating through, but banged his shoulder on the airlock badly enough to leave a bruise. He'd had a little experience before, in the military, and of course getting from the elevator to Little Mars, perhaps just enough to make him too confident. My immediate concern was the plants. A small apple tree had gone off exploring and made it almost to the galley, and a couple of tomato plants had gotten loose. Merrill unshipped the hand vacuum and was chasing down the floating particles of medium before we had a chance to ingest them. I returned the apple tree to its proper place and replanted the tomato vines. The three spooks were doing the various things people do when they're getting used to zero-G, except barfing, fortunately. They practiced pushing off from surfaces and trying to control spinning. Once you get the hang of it, it's not hard to eyeball the distance to wherever you're going and do a half turn, or one and a half turn, to land feet first. You can also swim short distances, but nobody needs that much exercise. There was a very distinct look in Dustin's eye, and Elsa returned it. I hoped it worked for them better than it does for most. Paul and I first had sex in zero-G, and it worked all right. My first time with anybody, whatever the gravity, so it was a double miracle for me. Snowbird and Flyin' Amber were clumsy in zero-G. The gecko slippers were less effective with them, since they had more inertia than humans. If I'm moving slowly and put my foot down onto a beige spot, it will stop me. Snowbird has four times my mass, though, and will rip off and keep going. I went into Mars territory with her to check their garden, since it was easier for me to move around and manipulate things. It was dark and cold, as it was supposed to be. Their garden was simpler than ours. Martian tastes didn't run into a lot of variety. Trays of stuff that resembled fungi in a few stubby trees. As on our side, one of the trees had come loose, but it was easy to retrieve and fix with duct tape. A screen all along one wall was a panorama of their underground city, which was almost all of her planet she had ever seen, though Mars wasn't her planet the way Earth was ours. They had known for thousands of years that Mars was not their natural home. They only learned recently that they were put on Mars as a sort of warning system for the others. When humans had advanced enough technologically to come in contact with the Martians, they were advanced enough to present a danger to the others, even light years away, which led to the others' attempt to destroy us, thwarted by Paul and the Martian leader, Red. The cataclysmic explosion that was supposed to sterilize Earth only rearranged the far side of the moon, killing Red in the process. So, from one point of view, the Martians were humanity's saviors. Another point of view, more widely held, says that it was all the Martians' fault. And since I was the first to come into contact with them, I shared the blame. After taking care of the garden, we went into the Compromise Lounge, not quite as dark and cold. There was a bench for humans to sit on, not of much utility in zero-G, and a skillful mural of the above-ground part of our Mars colony, a mosaic of pebbles from both Earth and Mars. It was special to me, made by Oz, Dr. Oswald Penninger, who had been my mentor when I first came to Mars. I told Snowbird about it. "I met Dr. Oswald," she said. "I breathed for him." Oz had spent some time in the Martian city, measuring the metabolism of the various families. "I miss him," I said. "He was one of my closest friends." He and Josie might have been on this expedition if the corporation hadn't been pressured into taking three military people. "It is difficult for us to gauge human personality, but I can understand why you would like Dr. Oz. He is interested in everything. Or should I say, was, as you did? He will not live long enough to see us again." I should have said is, as long as the person is alive. "He told me about Norway," she said, "where he studied art. I'd like to go there someday. It sounds a little like Mars." "Maybe they'll do something about the gravity by then." "I hope so. This is nice." She pushed up gently, rose to the ceiling, and floated back down. But you are joking.
Yes. Gravity's like death and taxes. Always with us.
Not always. There's no gravity here. Nor death, nor taxes. Not for some time. And when we take off for Wolf 25, it will be the ship's acceleration that presses us to the floor.
Homemade gravity. You can't tell it from the real thing.
Ha ha. Dr. Einstein's principle of equivalence. A good joke.
Was it I who made the joke? Or Einstein?
I decided not to pursue it.
Dustin came into the lounge, sideways and a little fast. He crashed into a wall with a modicum of grace.
Good aim, I said. You want to work on the speed.
He brushed himself off, rotating toward the center of the room.
Good aim if I'd been aiming for this door, he said. Good afternoon, Snowbird. What's up?
Carmen helped us with a tree. Now we are discussing general relativity.
That raised his eyebrows a few millimeters.
A little beyond me. The math, anyhow.
Tensor calculus?
I had to come clean.
Don't ask me. I'm just sitting around being impressed.
What is tensor calculus?
To me, it was a big stop sign. I withdrew from the course and changed my major to philosophy. From physics.
Pretty drastic.
I try to be philosophical about it.
Snowbird, your family is both, right? Science and philosophy?
Not in the sense of being scientists and philosophers, no. We don't experiment traditionally. Not on things and not on ideas. I am in a small group that wants to change that. Which I think is why the others were glad to see me go. Traditionally, you know, we learn by rote. It's not like human physics and chemistry and biology. Things and processes are described in great detail, but those descriptions aren't tested and the underlying relationships aren't studied.
We'd call that Aristotelianism, in a way, if you had an Aristotle.
I know. It was studying the ways you classify different methods of thinking that made some of us want to change the ways we think.
Some of us who are not completely grown yet.
Flying Amber came drifting out of Mars territory.
Not completely sane.
He gently collided with me as I put my other foot down on the beige spot to anchor us.
Thank you. Snowbird was not yet two when you humans came. The novelty of it made a huge impression on her unformed mind.
You will never win this argument, or lose it, Snowbird said. I know you're wrong, and you know I'm wrong.
And since you are wrong, that settles it.
Fly and Amber crossed all four arms in a human-looking gesture.
That's logic.
Dustin stayed out of it, but I didn't.
Why does it have to be one or the other, Flyin' Amber? Your science was fine in the old days, but it wouldn't get you off Mars.
And to the planet of the others, where we'll be destroyed along with everybody on Earth and perhaps in Mars as well?
That's not progress, Carmen.
Not the example I would choose, Snowbird said.
But it's relevant, I insisted. Human science explained everything pretty well until we met you and found you had this energy-out-of-nowhere thing. Now we have to fit you into our universe just as you have to fit us into yours.
How can you say that? If you hadn't stumbled onto us, we could have happily gone on for an eternity, or at least until the cows came home, if we had cows.
Was that a joke, Flying Amber?
Of course not. I'm only trying to adapt to your idiom.
He pretends not to have a sense of humor, Snowbird said, which makes him even funnier.
Idiom, Flying Amber repeated. Idiom is not humor.
What does the philosopher say about that?
He grinned. I have enough for a monograph already. Humans do not understand this, and neither does Snowbird. Flying Amber made a complex gesture that started him rotating.
I reached out and stabilized him.
Thank you. It's not a concept that I can express in English or any human language.
He rattled off about 30 seconds of noises in the Martian consensus language.
I recognized 3 clear repeated sounds, one for negation, one for human, and one that signals an if-then statement.
Snowbird was totally still, absorbing it.
Can you translate? Dustin said.
Not exactly, no, but I could try to say part of it.
Flying Amber put his small hands together and made a slight bow, perhaps a parody of human gesture.
It's about the social function of humor in both races, as if humans were one culture, Flying Amber barked, and Snowbird answered with a series of clicks.
He points out that you are essentially one culture in Mars.
From the first time we communicated with Carmen, after we decided to let her know we spoke human languages, it's been obvious that humor both unites and separates the two species. Martian humor is almost always about helplessness, about fate and irony. Humans also recognize this, but most of your humor is about suffering, about pain, loss, death. To us, that preference itself is beautifully funny, and is even funnier as you think about it. Like a hall of mirrors, the images fading off into infinity.
I'm not saying this well, but for most of us, humor is absolutely necessary for survival. If you lived in a small hole in the ground and knew there would never be anything else, you would perhaps feel the same way.
Sort of like what we call gallows humor, Dustin said.
Ask for me tomorrow,
Flying Amber quoted, and you will find me a grave man.
He said it with a British acting voice. That was a BBC production of Romeo and Juliet in 1951. Very Martian humor. Mercutio has been stabbed and he jokes about dying. Most human humor is not so clear to me.
Nor as funny, Snowbird said. So many jokes about people falling down, which is hardly possible with 4 legs.
Sex jokes aren't funny because we have to figure out what the people are doing and why that's more funny than what they normally do.
She turned to Flying Amber and made the thumping laughter sound.
Only 2 people! Only 2!
Some of us don't think that's funny, Flying Amber said. They can't help the way they're made.
Do you tell jokes about Martian sex? Dustin asked.
Snowbird pantomimed scratching her head, which was kind of funny, avoiding all the eyes up there.
No. No fate or irony or helplessness there. What is there to laugh about?
Trust me, he said. Humans find Martian sex pretty entertaining.
But it's so plain and innocent compared to human sex. We don't hide away and do it in private, and kill people if they do it with the wrong person.
You'd never have a Shakespeare, I said.
I think we do have individuals like Shakespeare, Flying Amber said. Though it would be difficult to explain, to translate, what I mean by that.
I should think so, since you don't seem to have anything like drama.
Nothing dramatic used to happen to us before you came. I suppose we're going to need drama now.
And psychoanalysis, Dustin said. Social workers, police, and jails.
We look forward to evolving.